Thanks for joining us on the Future Food Show. This episode is part of the Transforming the Future of Protein series, where we explore the work of XPRIZE Feed the Next Billion, a global incentivized competition that challenges innovators to reinvent alternative proteins. On this episode, we're excited to host MJ Kinney and Cameron Semper. MJ is a food scientist and the founder of Fair Science, a consulting company that specializes in next-generation food product development. Her specialization in alternative proteins has spanned B2B, B2C, and nonprofit sectors, throughout which she has built collective experience in R&D, technical sales, and project management. Cameron is a research scientist who specializes in molecular biology and recombinant protein technology. As a New Harvest Research Fellow, he used protein biochemistry to study potential cost reductions for growth media used in fish cell culture. He is passionate about the potential of cellular agriculture to facilitate the transition to a more sustainable and decentralized food system. Cameron holds a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Calgary and is currently a postdoctoral fellow. This will be the second time that Cameron is joining us on the podcast. MJ and Cameron, I'd like to welcome you both to the Future Food Show.
Great to be back. Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks.
So Cameron, you've been on the show before, and I was actually just listening to our episode from quite some time ago. So if you're listening in, definitely take a look at the show notes so you could learn a little bit about Cameron's work. I'm excited to catch up with you, Cameron, and really excited to have MJ on the show. We're going to be talking about XPRIZE. And before we get started, MJ, maybe you can start telling us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I am a food scientist, and there are a lot of avenues that a food scientist can go into, and I chose product development. I specialize in plant-based product development, so utilizing alternative protein ingredients, and within the natural organic sector, and more specific to that, plant-based meat, egg, and dairy products. I got into this field kind of by luck. There really wasn't a curriculum for it when I went to school. I mean, specifically alternative proteins, let alone like plant-based specifically. And I started working in the industry in the B2B ingredient sector. So this is everything that kind of happens behind the scenes and mostly within the ingredient world, working with finished ingredients that are developed in such a unique way that they offer unique functional properties in the end products that they go into. And I was working within pea protein before it was cool. It was actually very uncool when I entered the industry, and there was very little hope for its adoption other than it could really compete with soy without being a top allergen. And that allowed me to, I mean, working within the B2B world, as some may know, you basically build as many applications, food applications as possible in order to get this ingredient to work. And so I was able to work across a wide variety of food product types, just utilizing this ingredient and really understanding the difference between certain plant proteins, certain levels of processing that's done to those plant proteins to make them a certain level of functional over others. And yeah, that allowed me to essentially go into the consulting world. Also worked in the B2C sector, so consumer products that are typically found within grocery retail settings, and also in the nonprofit world to kind of really bring more attention to the alternative protein space. But today what I do is I create plant-based products for clients on a private independent level, and hopefully those products make it into the grocery retail sector or food service category.
Cool. And MJ, I think the last time we connected, it might have been at an IFT event. And at the time you were working, I think, with the Good Food Institute. You have since actually gone on and started your own consultancy. Is that right?
That's right. And it's actually something that I was doing before my time with the Good Food Institute. It's just something that I couldn't focus on while like full time, at least while I was at the Good Food Institute. It never really quite stopped. I started consulting in 2017. But yes, very good memory. And I believe it was at IFT. It was definitely a very large trade show. And I'm certain it was IFT.
Okay, awesome. And Cameron, I guess I was looking back into when it was that you were on the show, and maybe this is an indication of how I think about the episodes, but I think it was about 35 episodes ago. Tell me a little bit about your background, even if it's overlapping from that episode, and what you've been up to lately.
Yeah, so I'm an academic researcher. That's still something that I do. I started becoming interesting in the alternative protein and the kind of cultured meat space when I was in grad school. And I just thought that it was really cool science. And, you know, I thought I can't wait for these products to become commercially available because I felt guilty about eating some of the meat products that you find in the grocery store, but I wasn't really satisfied with the alternative products that were on the market at that time. So this whole concept of cellular agriculture was something that, you know, immediately appealed to me. And then when I was working as a postdoctoral fellow, it was then that I started to kind of see opportunities to apply my expertise, which is in really molecular genetics and protein biochemistry. And I was able to kind of see avenues to apply that experience and those skills that I had to this kind of emerging field. So I was fortunate to be accepted into the New Harvest Fellowship Program. So I completed a project there where we created a low-cost methodology to produce growth factors that are used in growth medium for cell culture and with application for cultured meat production. And we've also gone on to do some other things. And then I'm also doing some work in the precision fermentation space using my background in fungal genetics to produce some proteins and small molecules that we currently derive from animals primarily and coming up with this alternative means to produce them. So I'm continuing to work actively as a researcher. And then a few years ago, I was invited by XPRIZE to contribute to this prize competition, which has been great. And it's been a really cool opportunity to kind of apply some of my learnings in this field to a whole different application, which is obviously the prize competition that we're running here.
MJ, when did you first kind of get started with the XPRIZE Feed the Next Billion challenge?
I got started a little before the prize actually became a reality. I was working with the Good Food Institute, and a lot of my time there was just connecting with people who had an interest in the space, and they're looking for just someone who has kind of an educated or informed view on alternative protein. And so I actually met with Caroline Colta maybe a year before the prize opened, just to help them explore whether or not there was merit for the prize and what some of the technical obstacles would be. Because the question at that time was like, is it even possible to use, you know, plant-derived ingredients, ingredients derived from precision fermentation or cultivated animal cells to actually build these products? And could whole muscle cuts be achieved? Because at that time, only the market offered restructured or essentially like nuggets or patties. So that's when I first became introduced to the team for Feed the Next Billion. And then a year later, before the prize was announced, I met with Caroline and her team again and was able to participate as a technical consultant. The question was raised if I wanted to participate as an actual team, and it really was of interest. I also knew that there was going to be as something like existing the first time. Like I've never, as a product developer, this is like kind of like the dream project to have, to participate as like a team to build this prototype, because like there's never been a better incentive. First place is $7 million and there's no strings attached to that. You don't even have to necessarily build the food product or business to make it happen, but to be afforded that kind of funding just to be curious and to act on that was really fascinating. But I'm really proud of, like, you know, it's only like when you look back, you're like trying to make sense of your life. And I'm like, you know, I've been through these three different sectors in my industry. I've met a lot of people. I understand how this industry kind of works in the big picture view of things. And it was really thanks to working across B2B, B2C, and nonprofit, and especially all the relationships afforded within the Good Food Institute, that I was able to like bring in a lot of other stakeholders to understand and help contribute to this prize happening at the level that we wanted to see it.
MJ, you did a very good job of kind of explaining how XPRIZE reached out to the community before officially starting the challenge. And maybe this is directed towards Cameron. Tell us a little bit about how XPRIZE listened to the community before officially announcing, because it seems like they've done a very good job, of course, working with experts like yourself, but really understanding what's possible. Cameron, can you shed some additional light on? And then MJ, I'll come back to you on that as well.
Yeah, I think there was an extensive research phase while the project was being designed, and that actually predates, you know, my involvement. I know they reached out to a lot of experts in the field and had a lot of great conversations. And when they launched the prize, they had already assembled a really impressive panel of advisory board members, as well as judges who have, you know, varied and relevant expertise in a variety of the kind of different sectors within this alternative protein space. And I think the thing that XPRIZE really prioritized was like very difficult, but still achievable. And I think that they really did a good job of kind of meeting that goal by setting out the parameters for the competition. And I think that, yeah, the key was they didn't want to make it too easy. They didn't want, you know, just competitors to submit prototypes and products that are not so different from what we were already seeing on the market. But at the same time, they didn't want it to be completely impossible and where they, you know, there wasn't going to be anything to show. So I think that, yeah, just they really invested a lot of time and did their due diligence to, you know, interact with a lot of different stakeholders. And that's shown through the result of the competition with, A, that, you know, the caliber of teams that we've had competing, as well as the, you know, how basically just how things have gone, you know, thus far.
Something I really appreciated was this acknowledgement that no one person has all the answers, and bringing on board a judging panel, which is composed of experts that offer a lot of different insights that ultimately build into the details that we ask per parameter within the competition and at different phases of the competition. So we wrapped up semifinals back in May when we were in Singapore, and now we're entering into the final stage. So having a judging panel really meant a lot, because Cameron and I both bring a lot of knowledge and insight into the space, but I know that as we're going into the nitty-gritty of what we ask of teams, so not just kind of why is this criteria important, but what does a deliverable look like? What does testing look like? What does the methodology of that testing look like? We really leaned on our judging panel for a lot of that, as well as our advisory board. I think another way in which XPRIZE listened to the community, this is like the community of participants, meaning teams in the competition. We have various technological approaches, plant-based, precision fermentation, also cultivated animal cells being of them. And there's this acknowledgement that plant-based is definitely far more ahead in by comparison to the other two technological approaches I mentioned. And that means that the materials that we require to test certain parameters of this competition are really going to be shaped by what is feasible for, let's say, a cell-based team to yield in a certain period of time by comparison to a plant-based team. The material requirements, I think we worked really hard with our testing partners to really get it to as little an amount of product as possible while still upholding, you know, valid, credible information throughout this whole competition. But that's one area I know that like I really felt the squeeze of, we're really doing something bespoke here and really customized for the community that's involved.
It seems like you two work together quite a bit, as well as with some of the other advisors. Can you tell us about how often you interacted with either each other or some of the other advisors?
So Cameron and I see each other on a weekly basis. So we have a tech ops meeting weekly. So we're definitely not strangers to each other. We definitely lean on each other for every part of the competition where we have to essentially like deliver something. And I'm just thinking probably because of the meeting that we just got out of before this call, we're looking at each of those parameters right now, specifically the environmental impact and economic evaluation for the final stages. And, you know, we bring different insights and skill sets and strengths, and we both have to be, to an extent, our own project managers. But I really love, Cameron's really good at creating clarity around structure and templates. So I borrow from his work quite a bit in order to express my complicated ideas in a more clear fashion. But we're definitely not strangers to each other, Alex. We see each other quite often. And we've also had the fortune of traveling with each other to go to the various sites that we've been visiting since the start of this year. You know, we went to Abu Dhabi for our semifinals testing event and Singapore for the finalist teams that you know, essentially graduated from the semifinal stage and are now entering into the final stage of the competition.
Yeah, we speak regularly and I think really lean upon each other to try to make the competition as you know, rigorous as possible, but ideally pushing our teams in the right way so that they're kind of able to really challenge themselves and put together their best possible product that will advance the industry. And I know that I've learned, you know, an immeasurable amount about product development and the B2B space and all this stuff from MJ. So it's been a real privilege working with her throughout my time on the competition.
What's next in the lineup for the Feed the Next Billion Challenge? We have seen the finalists and kind of dug a little bit deeper into what each of them are doing, but what happens from here?
Well, our finalists are going to be very hard at work for the next several months working on improving their products. So earlier this year, they completed the semifinals phase, obviously, and that was a challenge. They had to, you know, formulate their products to meet a number of different criteria that we were testing, and we've increased the difficulty for finals. So we've added additional parameters that they need to meet, and we've upped the material requirements quite substantially. So our teams will be busy at work with developing their products and improving them and trying to win the prize. And on our end, we'll be busy trying to support them and trying to, you know, push them in the right way to make sure that, you know, they're as successful as possible.
You know, I think if I was like an outsider listening to this conversation, I would think like, dang, like how rigorous is this competition and why is it so hard? Just to offer some perspective in that area, this kind of goes back to like how naive I was when I chose to be a food scientist and a product developer. I very much thought that those decisions on like what products make it into the market rely upon the people who are creating it. But then I learned it relies upon like C-suite and marketing that feeds into what products are made, what parameters shape those products, as in how much protein will it offer per serving, what flavor profile will be utilized, what different SKUs will we offer of this product. That's all actually outside the technical realm. And what's really beautiful about this competition is like how solution agnostic it is in combination with how logical it is. This is not something that is shaped upon what necessarily C-suite and marketing need. It's really about creating maybe like the first of its kind as far as whole muscle cuts that are dictated by logical terms, and you know, our nutritional profile being a great example. We're not trying to define what is healthy or what is better in terms of its nutritional profile. We simply want it to match the animal origin on a one-to-one basis. And so as we're building out these, you know, rigorous criteria, we're really doing it from this lens of like, what is, you know, audacious but achievable, but also what can actually be utilized in a real life, you know, application for these teams that actually do decide to take their company further after they win that money, even if they don't have to. So wanted to give that perspective as well. So it's not just hard for the sake of being hard. It's hard for the sake of, if we really want to feed the next billion people, we're trying to get the teams the best tools and resources to make sure that happens.
No, I love that. And actually, it kind of shows that a challenge like this offers additional benefits compared to what maybe some other companies are doing. And that is a huge benefit. Let's, I guess, get creative here, because I know that the challenge is very well thought out. But if there was a new Feed the Next Billion challenge created today, how would it be different?
For starters, we would choose one species of fish. I think that would be one ask I would make. As you may know, Alex, this is for chicken breast and fish fillet. And in the original rules and regulations, it was not defined what type of fish species. Nor chicken, but you know, that is pretty standard. So we did make a lot of work for ourselves in a way that we never could have anticipated by offering teams the option to choose their fish type. So that's one. That's very low-hanging fruit. I'll think of a better answer, but that one just popped right out for me.
I think for me, if I were going to, you know, do a second iteration, I would actually remove the shackles a little bit. I would say that it doesn't need to be chicken or fish. And I would open up the possibility for, you know, additional creativity and kind of scientific discovery in this space. And I think that sometimes the field of cellular agriculture is rightfully very focused on trying to replicate the meat products and the dairy products that are on the market today, because everyone's familiar with that. Mm-hmm. But I think eventually it will be possible for, you know, new ideas and new kind of truly novel foods rather than just novel ways of producing foods that we're familiar with. So I think that would be a really cool way to promote innovation in a future if there were ever a 2.0 competition.
I love the contrast between answers there. And I guess, you know, thinking a little bit outside of the competition and maybe how the future food or maybe even novel protein industry has changed since the program started, so the last couple of years, how has the work that each of you have individually been doing changed over the last few years?
Well, that kind of builds into something I wanted to say in response to Cameron's answer. So this might get a little complicated, but going back to what Cameron had said, if he could choose any type of animal origin, I remember Cameron and I had this conversation, I think in Singapore, and he had responded with octopus. And while there's not a lot of data maybe that exists within the CPG space of grocery retail to justify octopus, I think it's a very worthy like answer or possibility to have acted on if we could do a 2.0, because we've learned so much within the course of this competition that we could not have anticipated. So for cultivated meat specifically, I remember like around the time we met Alex, like five years ago, it was a discussion around cell-based ingredients being utilized as B2B ingredients that companies would then purchase to create cultivated meat products, like end products. And now when we look at the industry with the companies that are currently still standing, it is very much a food service approach and premium dining. So octopus would have totally, or potentially, I can't say with certainty, it probably would have been a really great thing to have available, because I think that's a perfect example of something that consumers are willing to pay a premium price for in like a very fine dining type environment, which is currently what cultivated meat is able to do. But going back to your question of like how things have changed in our industry and like how that's affected our work, I know that for me, there was this huge burst of interest in plant-based meat products, and everyone was just kind of fighting to be in the space and the same space as what the data currently at that time had supported to be successful. So basically, you know, Impossible Meat and Beyond came into the world, then restructured products, meaning like burgers, patties, or even just grounds became a priority because the data existed to support, you know, essentially risk-averse companies into acting on innovation because they had that metric to work with. And it's been really cool to see more of an emphasis on where the data doesn't exist, but where like intuition exists, that, wow, the market's like really saturated with these burger patties. Maybe we should offer, you know, something different than beef. Maybe we should offer something different than restructured for a format. So that's one major change. But in recent months, it has been the change I think that people don't really want to talk about because it's not exactly exciting or happy, which is that plant-based is at this inflection point where we don't really know if it's going to do well. The companies that are in it haven't been doing well for some time. And I'm really excited to see what might happen in terms of, you know, relying less on the data, because I think that many companies are very beholden to it and relying more on intuition of what people actually want to eat versus what's popular and what the market doesn't currently offer. So like, what are those white space opportunities? And I'd like to see more respect paid to the creative people who are actually building these products so that they have the proper incentive to build something great, because that currently does not exist.
That was very interesting, MJ, because also I think earlier this year, there was a kind of a request request for startups from ProVeg Incubator to work on cell cultivated octopus. So I'd love to actually ask them about it too. And maybe there's some collaboration here. But Cameron, I guess to reiterate the question, you know, how has the food industry or even the cellular agriculture landscape changed over the last few years since you started either working on this challenge or really kind of getting into the food space?
It's changed a lot. I mean, we've seen the, you know, the kind of preliminary, you know, regulatory type approval in multiple countries now. And that's obviously very exciting. And I think from the academic literature, we're seeing a lot more publications on this area, and we're seeing a lot of really cool science being done. And I think what that's helping myself and other researchers in the field to do is really hone in on what are some of the real key challenges. And, you know, I think early on, a lot of the work was figuring out, you know, what are the hardest things to do? Because it was such a new area, it wasn't entirely, you know, immediately clear what would be the kind of grand challenges. And I think that we have, you know, a better idea of what those are. So I think that now we're starting to see a little bit of a narrowing of focus in the research phase. And I'm sure this is occurring in all these startups that are existing as well. And they're all kind of now focused on their key challenges and their key deliverables as they kind of advance going forward. So I think that it's a little bit less exploratory than it used to be. But, you know, and I do think that that comes with kind of a positive and a negative. The positive is obviously it's very focused and it's driven towards a specific goal. But, you know, I do worry a little bit that some of that, you know, creativity and that kind of just, you know, discovery, basic scientific research that could help adjacent fields or other applications of this field are maybe not being given the attention that they were initially. So I think it's going to ebb and flow and it's going to oscillate. And we're kind of in a focused phase right now as, you know, a lot of the startups were obviously promising products on shelves by certain dates. And, you know, we haven't seen too many of those quite yet. So I think that they're hard at work trying to deliver on those promises. And then, you know, hopefully once we see those, you know, deliverables and those products coming out, and that will kind of free up some investment capital, some research capital to be a little bit more exploratory and start to come up with other cool things that we can do within this broad field of cellular agriculture.
I want to go off on a little bit of a tangent here. Cameron, given your past research in growth factors, I wanted to ask you what you think about some of the approaches these newer companies are doing.
I mean, I've seen a lot of really unique approaches to kind of the growth factor media development side of things. And I love to see the different approaches. I love to see all the creativity. You know, I don't have a favorite. I don't think we're ready to pick a winner or anything like that. But I think that there's definitely been a lot of advancement. I know that we've seen people using, you know, cell culture to create a serum-like substance. I've seen people or companies doing applications where they are engineering cells so that they're producing their own growth factors. And then, of course, you know, my area, which is, you know, low-cost growth factor production, we've seen a lot of development in that. I have seen a lot of creative approaches in the field, and I think that it's good because I don't think we're there quite yet for really cost competitive production, at least not with what I've seen. I think that there still needs to be significantly more research in this area to try to get those media costs down, you know, even further so that we can ensure that when the products come out, once all the final regulatory hurdles are passed, that, you know, the price point is palatable to consumers and, you know, along with, you know, the products themselves.
You know, generally speaking, you know, outside of the challenge, what are some future food technologies that are starting to gain momentum now that you're excited about?
I can tell you some things in the plant-based space that have sparked a lot of continued interest. And while I'm excited about them, I haven't quite seen the results I'd like to see, but it is still a very important space, which is to have more finished ingredients that meet the parameters that, you know, plant-based meat, egg, and dairy companies want, which is going to be something that has kind of like a pantry level or kitchen level of familiarity with the consumer, what in the industry we call clean label, something that's also going to do a lot of the heavy lifting for the product developer who's looking for a unique set of functional properties and for them to be really strong so that the usage level is very low, which contributes to a bit of a cost story when developing prototypes. But I have long been excited about seeing ingredients that deliver on any of the functionality of egg, but especially with binding and kind of the properties that you see in the cookability realm of egg, just had with vegan ingredients or non-animal derived, or if they are animal derived, to be derived in a fashion like precision fermentation. There have been attempts using plant-derived ingredients to compete with things like methylcellulose, but I haven't yet to date seen anything that really does that. there's a lot of talk about it. And I think that companies know it's very important for product developers. I feel it's a little sinful, not that I'm religious, but for there to be so much talk about an ingredient being able to deliver on a functional property that just is not had. But if somebody does have that capability with an ingredient, I don't see a world where it wouldn't be wildly successful, because it's been an ingredient I've long been looking for, which is an alternative to methyl cellulose or something that delivers on the functionality of an egg in specifically binding, but clean label and vegan.
Interesting. Okay. And Cameron, what are some future foods or technologies that you're excited about?
I'm really excited about the real kind of bona fide tissue engineering approaches that some companies and researchers are taking to producing these meat alternatives. So, you know, I have, you know, great respect for approaches that are hybrid in nature and utilize plant-based ingredients as well as, you know, cell-based components. But I have a strong affinity for these, you know, early stage products that are almost entirely animal cell based, because I think that it's an incredibly difficult technical challenge, but I do think that it has a lot of potential in terms of producing a product that is most similar to, you know, what people are familiar with that's derived from animals. And I also think that that kind of research can have a lot of other applications even beyond cellular agriculture, you know, in tissue engineering and biomedicine. So that's something that I very keen to continue to follow along with and see how it develops in the coming years.
Each of you had gone to Singapore for XPRIZE. I wanted to ask if you were able to try some of the publicly available cell cultured meat. Were you guys able to try it there?
Unfortunately, we were not. There was a very long wait list. We were very keen to try it. I think everyone that was visiting was very excited, but unfortunately, the wait list was so full, they weren't even accepting new people to apply to the wait list. So perhaps that speaks to the incredible demand for the products, but unfortunately we weren't able to try it.
And those wait lists are even full now here, now that it's opened up in the US as well. But that is a really good thing, right? That's what we want.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask each of you if you have any last insights for our listeners today before we close off.
I can start. I think that price has long been a focus for not just this competition, but in developing, you know, what is going to be the next generation, which is just non-animal derived meat, egg, and dairy products. How much of an emphasis seems to be on the cost of the raw materials or the operations to make those products? I'd like to see more of an emphasis on the role that retailers play in that equation on price. I think that a lot of people do know that it's really at the discretion of the retailer to set those prices and their margins. And I wonder how much of that is actually responsible for the high cost that we're seeing at the grocery store. And I think there's also just something to be said about how these products are really deemed to be something worthy of a premium by retailers. And if that's the view they're going to take, like how there will ever be an existence for price parity in the market.
Yeah, I think my parting thought would probably just be to encourage patience and sustained enthusiasm. I think that as a scientific researcher who's, you know, actively working on research and development in this space, I think that it's sometimes forgotten how big of a challenge it really is to do the things that these companies and these researchers are doing. And I know that, you know, some of the initial projections for timeline, maybe they haven't quite been met, or the industry is a little bit behind some of the earlier projections. But, you know, I see kind of firsthand the amazing, you know, research and development that's occurring. So I still remain extremely enthusiastic and excited about the field. And I hope that, you know, everyone who listens to this podcast feels the same way and continues to sustain that excitement and support in the coming years.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank both of you for being on the show, and I want to thank the listeners for tuning in to the XPRIZE Feed the Next Billion, Transforming the Future of Protein series. To learn more about XPRIZE, you can check out www.xprize.org/feed. MJ and Cameron, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
This is your host, Alex, and we look forward to seeing you on our next episode.